I'm going to try to get to you, and hopefully you can do something between now and then and give us a slightly stronger signal, Bill. If they had stocked more deeply, they would have been spending more money on purchasing the equipment and stocking charge and warehousing charge and inventory charge. Because LIPA already is the second most expensive electricity in all of the United States. It is the most expensive electricity in the continental United States. The only electric company that charges its customers a higher rate is a small company in Hawaii. So because of Shoreham Nuclear Station, and we're still paying for it, already we've got the highest possible rates. You're now saying they should stock more deeply, which means pay more money, which means whatever extra revenue they've got, whatever profit margin they've got, would decrease if they followed your suggestion. Therefore, the rates to the ratepayers would increase. Had they followed Bernie's suggestion and your suggestion, things get more expensive, and the rates that are already the highest in the continental states would go up. Do you believe the customers would grumble a little bit if you did that, Glenn, KCQQIQ, K2LIW?
Well, I don't think that that's really an actual statement, an accurate statement, Dick, because looking at this from this point of view, there's some interesting things with utilities, the way that utilities run as opposed to other public services, that they can run them as profitable businesses. And in some areas, it's kind of like a strange thing. In other words, the Public Service Commission allows them to increase rates associated to certain... Public Service Commission basically looks at the expenditures that they're showing them, and that's what allows them to charge the rate. But if you, and of course anything you make above that is your profit. Now, what's interesting is that if you're telling the Public Service Commission what your expenses are, they're allowing you a rate, okay? But you've already told them that you have the transformers and the poles and the wires and the backup people on, you know, all the backup services that you need, and that's the reason why you're charging the rate that you are. There's a problem. Somebody was, had their hands in the cookie jar there, Dick. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Not Dick.
I don't think it's quite as simple as that. John recognized it's going to be right after Bill. As I see it, the rates are already as high as the customers will tolerate. You're saying that they should be doing these various things to increase the capability for a Hurricane Sandy-like event, which is going to increase the rates. The Hurricane Sandy event, in theory, is the once per 50 years. Let's see now. Gloria was 1986, 85, 86. That was, 25, 35 years ago. This is a once per 35-year event. We can stock the extra transformers and have them sitting there for 35 years, and every 35 years you need them, but in between, you're paying the price and increasing the rates accordingly. And you're not only increasing the rates in order to keep the Public Service Commission well-informed and try to run a certain profit, and you've got to try to run a certain profit ratio so that the stockholders are happy, because if the stockholders are not buying the stock, other bad things happen. Not quite that simple, but maybe Bill's got the answer to all this. WB2QGZ.
One quick comment to that. That's not completely accurate. Can I say one more comment to you before I go?
Go ahead, Glenn.
The other thing is this. Keep in mind, you're saying, okay, the areas that were most hard damaged, that of course they couldn't get that material stocked. Of course they couldn't bring in the crews to fix all that. But keep in mind, those areas were condemned. The area where I live, where the houses weren't condemned, they were just barely damaged. The first 2.5-3 weeks of the storm, there was no power down here. Why? Because there was no reason to come down here. They could have assessed, and they sent the people around to assess the damages, and they had 2-3 weeks before they got the clear to even start work down here. But that was already long decided. No one's complaining about that. What they're complaining about is the areas that weren't in the hardest hit areas that really were just standard storm damage. They didn't have the coverage of poles, transformers, or anything for even that, even with the additional crews. And areas like Staten Island and areas like Long Beach and other areas like that, they were condemned. They didn't have to turn the electricity back on there. So there's all kinds of things going on here that they didn't have to store all the stuff you're talking about. They just had to store the stuff that they were supposed to store, that they were telling the Public Service Commission that they had, that they didn't have. Maybe that's a little bit clearer. K2IW, KC2QIQ.
Are you saying lying took place between what was stated as stored versus what was really stored? Are you saying that there was a lie?
K2YO, Dick, yes, I said there are potentially indictments involved.
Okay. Bill, KC2QIQ, here we go. WB2QGZ, waiting patiently. Go right ahead, Bill. Straighten this all out, Bill. K2LIW and the Tech Man.
Yeah, no worries. Is this good enough? Should I go on my way to my time? How's the signal?
Your signal is 80% audio, 20% noise. We're hearing you very well. Please proceed.
Okay, I apologize for the mediocre signal. Not in a great spot. Number one, LIPA is an authority. Only job is to manage right now National Grid. So that's part of the problem. LIPA is a repository for political appointments. You don't necessarily have in the management structure of LIPA a lot of utility people. You have a lot of political hacks. And there are some very competent people there. There are also some very incompetent people there. Here's one of the reasons I say that. In the board meeting of the Long Island Power Authority, within 3 days prior to the storm, they spent 41 minutes discussing a new branding and logo for LIPA, and about 4 minutes discussing the storm. If you look at the minute meeting, in essence what they did is say, well, National Grid's got it. They're the service company. Let's move on. So the Long Island Power Authority did not take the point in this storm. They kind of cut it loose. The other issue is, you got to pay for this stuff up front or you pay it on the back. If you have the stuff around, so you don't have a lot of out-of-town crews at time and a half, or in some cases, double time and a half for straight 24-7 out working, if you have the equipment and the material to give them to fix stuff, and you don't have 30 crews idling in their trucks waiting for an assignment, you save a little bit of money that way. So I think the expense overall probably comes close to washing. Back to them.
Yeah, interesting information, Bill. Not a simple situation as I see it. There's a lot of players here. When it comes to what happened in Staten Island, where I'm guaranteeing now New Jersey Power and Light, or whatever it's called. No, it can't be New Jersey Power and Light. Staten Island, I guess it's Con Ed. Con Ed had a really ridiculous situation with the flooding of Manhattan, wiping out major transformers and the power to the subway, MTA, and whatever. Far from a simple life. And I guarantee that the portions of the flooded areas of Staten Island, I'm sure, were without power for a ridiculous length of time for reasons that are somewhat understandable, is my guess, John. But you were there, you lived there, and what was it like? To be B2, here we go, KC2WGB, K2RIW. Go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, we got hit pretty hard over here, and I forgive them because you can't prepare for what happened. But one thing you're missing, the transformer issue. Now, when Edison replaces a transformer, or LIPA or anybody else, if you notice, they're not new. They are rebuilt. How do they rebuild? From the old cores. Okay, so they only have X amount. They don't produce new transformers. So now, all of a sudden, 500 transformers go bad in the area. All right, they got to go back to be rebuilt. They don't have 500 in the rebuild plant. And new manufacturers, they don't stop, except the very common stuff. Everyone has to be made. So there's the delay in transformers, Dick. That's the major issue.
Wow. Okay. From your point of view then, John, what could Con Ed or LIPA have done better to prepare for Sandy? What options do you think they had if the majority of the so-called new transformers are really rebuilt? Because that core is very valuable, that can that is around it is very valuable. I'm guessing they're replacing the dielectric fluid that does the cooling, and the wiring is what's really being replaced. And so because of the sheer brand new cost of these things, you don't tend to stock a whole lot of brand new transformers, is what I think you're saying. So do you think there is a simple solution as to what could have been done better with our current knowledge? Over to you, John, KQRIW.
Well, Dick, Glenn brought up a very good point. The governor was complaining about LIPA, okay? Who set the rules on the stock and the quantity? Okay, public service. All right? That goes back to state power. He's responsible. That's called, they were actually sold out of trust, which is a violation. They had a contract which they didn't fulfill the requirements to have that contract given to them. So they were sold out of trust. They should be fined drastically. But for a 100-year storm or a 50-year storm, you can't prepare for it. You're going to take a hit. What you have to do is make sure you get your hospitals and the emergency areas back first and work from there intelligently. But having politicians saying anything is ridiculous. It's like my dog barking. Back to you, Dick.
I was watching a PBS program this week, and this is not quite appropriate, but it's somewhat close. This PBS program, I think it was the author of Portnoy's Complaint. I'm not sure which one of the programs it was, but anyhow, this leader in France, this is a supposedly a true situation. I guess it was a commander somewhere in France who said the following. My people are leaving. I've got to follow them because I'm their leader. When you lead a rabble, if your name is governor and you're leading this very complicated situation called New York State with all of its educational requirements and utility requirements and Con Ed and power and LIPA and whatever, there's no simple answer to any of it. Yeah, we can study the situation. We can do it better. But look what you got us into here, Neil. That was your original question about the power. Well, it's not even power wiring, but the signal wiring behind your house. I think it's not very dangerous. I'm going to move on, Neil, and we can come back to this because the way the power gets to our house and the way we amateurs are very skilled at creating standby power, emergency radio communication, battery backup systems, and whatever. This is a very appropriate situation for us because in a situation like Sandy, a hell of a lot of the vital communication was ham radio communication because almost everything else was out. We've all become extremely dependent on cell phones, and the reliabilities on cell phones in a situation like Sandy was a real eye-opener as I see it. Craig was the next person with a question. I hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this jazz, Craig. KD2, Charlie X-Ray Kilo, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Craig.
Well, I was just about to doze off there, Dick. KD2CXK, how are you? I want to bring it on back to QRP, which I think was the first question of the evening. A little twist on that, though. It's not a homebrew rig, but I got myself one of these very popular Yaesu FT817, which is a wonderful little tiny package with barely enough power to get out, but the unit itself is wonderful. Anyway, I want to experiment with backpacking with this radio. And I'm sure that the best way to do that is, of course, to bring along one of these very small and readily available automatic antenna tuners. However, if I choose not to go that route, and let's say keep it to 40 meters or 20 meters, and I want to use we can do like a makeshift dipole. The question I have is, do I need to have the counterpoise exactly as long as the radiant element? Or can I get away with possibly having a single counterpoise and just changing the radiant element tuned for the center of the band?
Yeah, there's a little bit of conflict in terms, which I'm hoping to straighten out here, Craig, and that is counterpoise, radiant element, and dipole. In the case of a properly fed dipole, a dipole is itself a thoroughly symmetric antenna. And everybody thinks that the dipole fed with its, any ideal world twin lead, and you think at one instant in time you're putting positive voltage on the right side and negative voltage on the left side of the dipole, and then on the second half cycle you reverse that. You think you're putting opposite polarity on the dipole. You're really not. You're pumping current into the right-hand side, subtracting current out of the left-hand side on the first half cycle. That means the direction of current flow on that dipole, left side and right side, is the identical current flow on the first half cycle. On the second half cycle, it goes the other way. The dipole is a thoroughly symmetric antenna, independent of ground. That dipole could be sitting in the hand, if it's a VHF dipole, could be sitting in the hand of an astronaut, floating free in space with his extravehicular activity suit, and he's floating in space 160 miles above planet Earth. He doesn't need ground. So when you're using a thoroughly symmetric antenna, no ground, no counterpoise is required. The word counterpoise, let me give you a couple of words on where that came from. I got that dipole in free space. Polarity-wise, the right side is positive, left side is negative at this instant of time. Therefore, there's a neutral plane down the center of the dipole. I could put an infinite sheet of metal at right angles to the dipole right down the center. I'd be in the neutral plane. It would make no change of the impedance, the gain, the pattern. Nothing would change in the dipole when I put that infinite sheet of metal right down the middle at right angles to the wire. Now, once you accept that sheet of metal, I can decide to use the right-hand side of the dipole, throw away the left-hand side, and feed it with reference to the sheet of metal. The sheet of metal now becomes a mirror where the right-hand side is there, the mirror image of the left side is there in the mirror, in that sheet of metal. And now you and I take that situation, rotate it 90 degrees, we call it a vertical ground plane. So the word counterpoise is what should have been an infinite sheet of metal to properly feed a dipole. That is the real counterpoise. So if you're using a quarter wave, let's say it's only half the dipole, if you're using a quarter wave radiator, then in theory, if you want high efficiency, you've got to create that infinite sheet of metal. If you really want high efficiency, you're not going to really fill up your backyard with a sheet of metal. You're going to lay down a whole bunch of ground plane radios. And if you're serious, you're going to put down 32 of them. If you're not serious, you're going to put down 3 of them. You put down 3 of them. Let me drop. That's a skeleton equivalent of that infinite sheet of metal that should have been there in the beginning. And as such, a lot of RF energy is flowing in between those wires into the ground. The ground is a volumetric resistive material that sucks up your RF energy and converts it into heat. So the efficiency of the antenna goes down pretty fast as you start skipping on the ground plane radials. If your radiator is full half wave long, not quarter wave long, and even if it's a vertical dipole fed from the ground, no counterpoise is required. You're feeding the outer end of a dipole where it's 1,500 ohms. You're feeding with reference to one single ground rod. That's if you want to put up a vertical half-wave dipole or long wire-like antenna. A simple ground rod is all you need for a counterpoise because you're feeding 1,500 ohms and you're not feeding 35 ohms is what you're feeding when you're feeding a quarter-wave monopole, so-called vertical ground plane antenna. So when it comes to backpacks, as long as you've got the right kind of a slingshot or whatever that can launch your dipole, full symmetric dipole, and you can get at a reasonable altitude in the air, there is no counterpoise required, no ground requirement. That, under that situation where the antenna does all of the radiating all by itself, the only thing then you care about is the fact that you are getting a reflection off the ground, which means that there's a real dipole above the ground, there's a mirror image of one below the ground, they are beating against each other as far as the signal out to the horizon is concerned. Let me drop. So once you've selected a full half-wave dipole, an independent antenna that doesn't require ground, the only thing left for you to worry about is, am I mounting it high enough above the ground so that the vertical angle of radiation is going to hit that ionosphere at a grazing-like angle that you desire, a low enough angle, so that you get some real DX out of it. If you mount the dipole pretty close to the ground in wavelengths, then it becomes a near-vertical incident sky wave. In other words, you squirt the antenna straight up in the air. For horizontal dipole. If you're a little bit smarter and you use your slingshot to shoot a monofilament line in the air above a tree and you hang a vertical half-wave dipole, you'll get a hell of a lot more efficiency. The altitude above the ground no longer counts because a vertical polarized dipole gives you a ground reflection that is co-phase, and therefore you get a low angle of radiation. A horizontal dipole, when a horizontally polarized signal hits the ground, the part that reflects off the ground flips in phase from plus to minus, so to speak. Therefore, you've got a real antenna above ground with a horizontal dipole. You've got a mirror image of one below the ground. They beat against each other and give you a null on the horizon. And at some angle above the horizon is where the signal falls as a function of how many wavelengths your antenna is above the ground. So a smarter guy, in my opinion, with portable backpacking, QRP, is going to start hanging half-wave, end-fed, vertical. When you feed that outer edge of the dipole, the only thing you've got to correct for ahead of time is you're feeding 1,500 ohms instead of 35 ohms or 70 ohms. So you need a little bit of an impedance matching device. One inductor and one capacitor will do that. And if you go to the QRZ.com, you go to amateurradio.tv last week. We discussed how to do that last week. And maybe you had a chance to hear that particular repeater. Time out. So as I was saying, maybe you had a chance to hear that particular discussion last week, and you can go back to amateurradio.tv and review it. Maybe that information helps a little bit, Craig. KD2CXK, K2IW and TechNet. Hope you're able to get over this jamming signal.
KD2CXK. Thanks a lot, Dick. I'm going to go check that out. The only question one more clarification on, you had mentioned that a vertical dipole, and I would not need a counterpoise. I could use a ground system. What would be your best suggestion to solve that?
See, if I simply put a ground rod in the ground, in ordinary soil, I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe it's got the 40 ohms of impedance to the rest of the earth. And if I'm feeding 40 ohms of resistive impedance from my ground rod, and I'm feeding the bottom of a quarter wave ground plane radiator, 35 ohms of radiator impedance and 50 ohms of resistance in my rod, that's a pretty lousy efficiency, as you can tell. You're wasting 60% of your power. If I'm feeding the outer end of a full half-wave dipole, it's electronically half-wave, even if you don't have enough wire to make it physically half-wave, if you put loading coils and helical winded top hat capacitors and whatever, as long as your radiator is electronically a half wave and you're feeding the outer edge of it, you're feeding a 1,500 ohm impedance. When I'm feeding 1,500 ohms and against a simple ground rod, which has got 50 ohms because it didn't sink into the ground very far and there's not seawater nearby, 50 ohms of resistance that's wasting compared to 1,500 ohms of radiation resistance, 90% of your power is going the right direction. A very simple ground rod can be more than enough counterpoise when you feed the outer edge. And the dipole itself is a high Q circuit. Let me drop. It's just like your daughter on the swing, which is a resonant pendulum, so to speak. And you're pushing her with your finger. And after you push her 30 times, she builds up a nice big oscillation amplitude. That's exactly what a dipole is. The energy launched from your transmission line and your transmitter into that dipole is feeding a high Q circuit. The RF energy is going to bounce back and forth on your dipole 20 times before it finally gets radiated. That's why you resonate it. You want all those bounces to stay in phase with each other, co-phase, to stay in step with each other. That's called resonance. Once it's a resonant half-wave dipole and you feed the outer edge, and you don't have to feed the outer edge, you can feed the center or anywhere along the lines you want, as long as you have the right impedance match. But feeding the outer edge, the disadvantage is you're feeding 1,500 ohms of resistance. The advantage is the dipole is vertical, gives you beautiful low angle of radiation, the phase center is higher above the ground than most other techniques, and you're feeding a high impedance with a very simple ground plane, a very simple counterpoise, does the charm very nicely with a simple inductor capacitor as an impedance matching network, an L network it's called. And the exact the design of that L network you can get by going to the website of Berkeley. If you Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, Berkeley plus impedance match, you'll get the Berkeley program. The Berkeley program asks you, what's the the impedance of your transmitter? What's the impedance of your load, resistive and reactive component? Plug in the numbers and press calculate, and it gives you 16, count them, 1-6 answers with the diagram, with the values, and you choose the one that you like. Back to you, Craig. KD2-CXK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Dick, and thanks for clarifying that, and I'll let you move on as it's getting late. I have some homework to do. KD2-CXK, thank you very much. Have a great holiday, everyone.
Yeah, we're not familiar with feeding 1,500 ohms. It scares the hell out of us, Craig. And we're not familiar with the pure vertical half-wave dipole. Very few people have done it for poor reasons. They don't understand it. And you would think that impedance matching network is a great big expensive antenna tuner. No way. When you go to that website of Berkeley and you find out that you need, let me pick a number, maybe it's 12 microhenries an inductor and an 82 picofarad capacitor. And you're going to make it an air variable capacitor so you can tune it, 82 picofarad. In my example, I think it was the example I did for 40 meters. And when it comes to the coil, that's some number of turns on a coil form that give you the right number of microhenries. Very simple. In other words, except for the air variable capacitor, which maybe is going to cost you a few dollars, the coil itself is a coil of wire wrapped around maybe some PVC pipe. The components themselves are a couple of dollars to do the impedance matching. It doesn't have to be a $200 antenna tuner to match 50 ohms up to 1,500. It's a lot simpler than you think. And so it's just a lack of familiarity because all the text that we read on ham radio practice for the questions don't show a pure vertical half-wave dipole. They always show a half-wave dipole fed in the center. And we all come to believe that that's the only way to do it. It happens to be the most difficult way to do it in some circumstances. Okay, give this thing a chance. The one guy who we all know who did it, it was Mel, K2KEY. He ran the pure vertical green piece of, I think it was 18-gauge wire in the evergreen tree out in front of his house in Manhattan Beach, Queens, in Brooklyn. And he ran that for a number of years. It was the best antenna he ever ran. He was telling everybody about how great it was. They gave him great signal reports on that very simple
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
That was a very simple antenna. He could easily, with a slingshot, go to any park in the world and set that up as long as the park ranger would let you use a slingshot, if you know what I mean, or a bow and arrow, or climb the tree. He did it by climbing the tree. Okay, good luck with that project, Craig. Let us know how it works. I think we've answered all the questions of the people who signed in. Time to go over to the mailbag. And, John, some of these guys who write you are real budding scientists as well as ham radio future operators. KC2WGB, K2RIW. What kind of crazy questions did they ask you this week, John?
Well, a little bit of a slow week, but we have some interesting questions. And happy holidays to everyone on the net. And good evening. Okay, here's one. Talking about the operational amplifier. This young guy wants to build a heliostat. Let me let it drop. What he'd like to do, he's going to put up two photodetectors, photocells, on a device. He's going to feed that to an operational amplifier and try to have the operational amplifier rotate this device until it has equal exposure to the sun. What do you think of the possibility of making this actually work? I don't know why he wants to do this, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, try to give me a couple of words now. Heliostat, I've heard the word. I'm having trouble placing what it is. To put two photo detectors on the end of, let's say, a wooden yardstick and rotate them in such a way that they give you equal performance on measuring solar energy. I can see that. And feeding them into an op amp, I can see that. And assuming that the two photocells have the exact same orientation, And as I start rotating that yardstick with these things on the two tips, the energy is going to fall off, in theory, equally on both sides. Therefore, the op amp, which is looking for differential voltage, is not going to see anything. If I did aim the two in a slightly different direction, if the one on the right-hand side of the yardstick is aimed a little more clockwise, the one on the left side is a little bit more counterclockwise, yes, now I've got a kind of direction-finding antenna. And so I could use that, yes, for making sure the yardstick is always at right angles to the sunshine coming in. So if I create differential antenna patterns out of the two photodetectors, I can do all kinds of finding out where the sun is, and maybe that's what's going on here. Maybe he wants to be able to have his solar cells on his house track the sun without doing it with motors, with automatic timing type devices. Back to you, John, for clarification. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Very close, Dick. The heliostat keeps the position of the sun. Exactly. Now, it's sort of similar in effect to your palladium on the ends of the, polonium on the ends of the yardstick. So what he wants to do is he has an antenna that has to follow the sun pretty closely. He's listening to the noise in the sun. He didn't say what frequency, but has to track the sun. So if there's a difference, first of all, he has to have, of course, matched cells or a way to adjust the voltages from those cells when they're both pointing in the identical direction. He said they're going to be approximately 3 feet apart and going to an op amp and then a servo mechanism. Do you think it would work?
By way of your simplistic description, the answer is sort of no at first, but it's very modifiable. I've got the, you said 3 feet apart, so I'm going to call it a wooden yardstick. I've got a wooden yardstick. I've got some kind of photodetector on the right side, and a photodetector on the left side of the yardstick, and wiring coming to my op amp in the middle, and that goes to a meter, a motor, a servo mechanism, or whatever. If the antenna pattern of the right-hand photodetector and the antenna pattern of the left-hand photodetector are identical patterns, and if they're both four-sided, directly at right angles to the yardstick, then as I rotate the yardstick, and I start off with the yardstick right angles to the sunlight is coming straight into the bore site maximum performance of each one of the photocells. And now as I rotate the yardstick, I go off of bore site of the photocells, and they both fall off by the same ratio. I have no differential signal. However, if I'm smart enough to create a differential signal, in other words, if the right-hand photocell has its bore site a little bit more clockwise from the sun, and the left-hand photodetector, its bore site is a little bit more counterclockwise from the sun, now as I rotate the yardstick left and right, rotate it in azimuth, one of those photocells starts coming into bore site with the sun, sees a stronger signal, and the other one goes further away from bore site and sees a weaker signal. Now I've got a differential signal I can measure. So by making different antenna patterns that are not collinear, I can force it. I can make it work. That's one approach. There's another very simple approach you should consider. Let me drop. When it comes to solid-state cameras these days, charge-coupled device cameras, every one of your modern-day cell phones has a camera built in. The real camera module in there with modern-day high production rate is probably $5 worth of electronics. And it's got all kinds of sensitivity and automatic focusing and whatever. And probably it cannot tolerate looking straight at the sun. But that's just a matter of putting the right kind of a sunshade in front of it, the right kind of sunglasses. You put the right kind of sunglasses in front of the lens of one of the cameras that you get out of a defunct cell phone. You've now got a beautiful way of displaying the sun. Make believe now that you're looking at that picture on a television screen, and when your electronics is properly aimed at the sun is the bright spot in the middle of the screen. Now, as you get an error in azimuth or elevation, the picture on the television screen, looking at that camera, the bright spot is going to move left or right, up or down. The position on the screen tells you the error. And because the picture on that screen was done by horizontal scan lines, as the picture moves to the right of center on each individual horizontal scan line, you're going to be getting the peak of signal a little bit to the right of center of each one of those sawtooth waveforms. That's for the horizontal scan. And for the vertical scan, which one of the horizontal lines sees the sun the maximum. So that picture on the screen gives you everything you want to know about where is the sun compared to where you want it to be. So a properly used charge-coupled device camera with the right kind of a protective lens, protective sunglass filter in front of it could give you the information a hell of a lot easier in an extremely small, inexpensive package. It's another possible approach. KC2.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2WGB. By the way, a number of my really enthusiastic radio control model airplane flyers have, as we speak, been taking those cameras out of cell sites, out of cell phones and other places like that, mounting them in the cockpit of their radio control model airplane, taking the video output, transmitting, putting it connected to a small transmitter. The transmitter transmits the signal down to the ground. The antenna on the ground picks up the signal. It goes into a headset of the pilot. The pilot wears this headset, and it's called first person piloting. The pilot now sees what the airplane sees as he's flying it. And can you imagine the amount of fun he has when he takes his radio control airplane at, let me pick a number, 500 feet in the air, turns it around 180 degrees and aims it toward him. He's looking at the picture of him on the ground as the airplane is flying toward him. Until the point of impact, can you imagine the amount of fun you have looking at that picture? KC2WGB, KQRIW in the tech van.
KC2MMY.
MMY recognized, but John first. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. Well, I imagine he could have a lot of fun with this. But, see, if he does that with a camera, now the interface and the controls for the servo would probably be a lot more complicated. He was looking to do it a little easier. Why don't you pick up, I believe that was that Ray?
That's Ray from Yonkers with a real cute looking dog on his website, on his QSZ.com website. Go ahead, Ray.
Yeah, hi, again, John. Yeah, I saw that somebody did that on YouTube, so I know it can be done with just two solar cells. Tracks the sun just fine. I think the trick to it was the two solar cells are next to each other, and the differential in voltage from the sun is created by having a nice long piece of cardboard in between the two cells, like a long nose, so to speak. And when you have that piece of cardboard there and the sun actually moves, there's enough of a differential because the cardboard casts a shadow on one of the cells that the op-amp can recognize it and turn the motor or what have you. So if the gentleman just wants to know who sent in the mail, there is a working model of it on YouTube. I don't know which, you know, I don't have the address or anything, but I'm sure if he Googles it or YouTubes it, he'll see someone that already built one over.
That may be the right answer, Ray. A piece of cardboard between the two, that creates the differential signal as you aim it. Just like you said, when you start rotating, a piece of cardboard casts a shadow on one of the solar cells, and that tells you that's the trailing one, and therefore you want to move in the opposite direction. So that's a nice, simple approach. When it comes to the electronics of doing it with a camera, the guys who are electronically savvy think it's simple. I'll admit that it's a lot more complicated than a piece of cardboard between two photocells. There's at least two approaches here. And I think the thing that the real optical engineers use is called a reticle. In other words, they've got a technique by which the signal comes through a single lens, and after coming through the single lens, it hits four separate photodetectors that are packed together real close. And the four photodetectors, you've got one in the upper left, one in the upper right, one in the lower left, one in the lower right. You've got these four photodetectors real close together. And when the whole network is aimed directly at the sun, the dot of the sun coming through the single lens hits the center four corners of each of the four photodetectors in the center. And as you start drifting one way or the other in azimuth or elevation, you start now putting more energy into one of those photodetectors, one or two of them, compared to the others. So the reticle approach is the classic way it's done. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, great idea with the cardboard in the center, or some kind of divider. And yeah, the reticle approach, or the limb approach as they call it, that'll work too. A little more work to build, but it'll work just fine. Okay, let me let it drop. We'll go on to the next one. You'll have fun with that. Okay, I have a gentleman with a question on his boat. When he goes out fishing out at the continental shelf, it's about 200 miles out, they have trouble with communications because of the rocking of the boat. What he wants to do is, he has it looks like a half wave or a linear, and he wants to gimbal mount it. He thinks that'll improve because it will stay perpendicular all the time. What do you think of the improvement chances, Dick? Back to you, KC2WGB.
Yeah, there's something called a gnomon. In other words, this is a device that by gravity hangs straight down, and therefore you know where zenith and nadir are, straight up, straight down, so to speak. That's great if you've got a steady environment. On the case of a sailboat, you've got quite a bit of rocking action going on. In the case of a powerboat, you've got a lot of rocking action going on. So without gyro stabilization, that's going to rock around in a funny way. To put some kind of gyro stabilization on the antenna is doable. However, do you really need that much collinear gain? As you start stacking vertically polarized collinear elements, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them together, and something like a station master antenna. This is one of those tall vertical antennas that you use at a repeater site. Can we drop? As you stack it higher and higher, the good news is you get more and more gain, and you get less and less bandwidth, and the gain is coming from, it's an omnidirectional pattern in azimuth, but it's becoming more and more narrow in elevation as you stack more and more elements. A rough rule of thumb is that you measure the number of wavelengths of your antenna in one of its dimensions, divide the number of wavelengths into, half wavelengths, you divide it into 70 degrees, and that's your vertical beamwidth. So a typical collinear antenna has a pancake pattern where maybe the vertical beamwidth of that pancake is a plus or minus 15 degrees. And if your boat rocks more than 15 degrees, then in the direction where it's rocking, that antenna, that beautiful antenna pancake pattern is now being aimed above the horizon or below the horizon, and you're getting a lot of boat rocking caused QSB, variation in signal strength. Let me drop. So you got a couple of choices here. There are various ways you can make the equivalent of gyro stabilization, which keeps the antenna always perpendicular to the sea level. There's ways you can gimbal that and do that. A little bit complicated, could be done. You can use an antenna which has got very little vertical extent to it, so it's got a broad vertical beamwidth. And you make the vertical beamwidth of the antenna like a dipole, which has got a beamwidth that is close to 85 degrees, plus or minus 42 degrees, is the beamwidth of a dipole. And as long as the boat doesn't rock more than 42 degrees, you're always in the main lobe, so to speak. And very little QSB, less than 3 dB of QSB, will take place if it's a simple half-wave vertical dipole. Yes, it's got less gain. As long as you've got enough transmitter power so that the shore side states can hear you, and as long as your receiver has a good enough low-noise receiver front end so that you can hear them, then that's a possible approach. So if you choose the high-gain collinear, you got to do something to make sure it stays perpendicular to the water. Let me drop. If you choose a lower-gain vertically polarized antenna, you don't have to worry about those details. But now you've got to overcome the less gain out of the antenna. Therefore, you better be transmitting more power, or you better have more receiver sensitivity, or the shoreside guy better be transmitting more power to you. And by the way, when you go 200 miles offshore, getting reliable communication for safety reasons is an important function. You cannot trust a cell phone out there. Marine radios, you can sort of trust those if you got a good one. There is one other approach which is elaborate. I'll mention it, but not many guys are going to take it. Let me drop. And that is, you could have the antenna with the high gain, a number of vertically stacked collinear elements with separate transmission lines. And now, by way of various kinds of electronics on board, you find out which way the boat is rocking, you know, whether it's rolling or pitching, and your electronics tells you the amount of roll or pitch, and you modify the signals going to that phased array, that vertically stacked phased array, so that you steer the beam accordingly, and therefore electronically make the antenna always squirt the signal out to the horizon. I said it's elaborate, but I was going to mention it as a possible approach. So that's the electronic approach. The brute force approach is simple dipole, and in between is the technique of gyrostabilization of the antenna. And the gyrostabilization of the antenna, I worry about that one, because when it fails, and you can't talk to shore, and you're trying to holler mayday, you know the way Murphy's Law works, or Elmer's Law. Elmer's Law states that Murphy was an optimist, the real world is worse. So you think you've anticipated the worst possible situation. With that gyrostabilization technique, you've got to worry about what's the backup when it fails. Are you going to have a manual override, or at least by way of some kind of a manual joystick, you can be readjusting the antenna as a function of the rocking of the boat so that you can keep communication with shore. KC2 WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2 WGB. Well, he does have a lot of options because this is a fairly large craft. His tuna tower, he's got a height above water, 43 feet. So this is a big boat. So he would have no problem running a dipole, and maybe he should put both antennas up. He's got the room for it, and maybe that would help solve his problem. Okay. Well, at least he has options. Very good. Let me let it drop. We'll go on to the next one.
Yeah, I like the idea of two antennas. The collinear during the time the boat is not rocking, and the backup is the dipole, the simple vertical dipole, that doesn't care about the rocking. And with enough testing out there, you'll find out it would be nice to find that if you run enough power, you'll have reliable enough communication as a simple half-wave dipole, and therefore worrying about the pancake pattern going above the horizon and below the horizon is not so bad. But 200 miles out to sea, you've got to really make sure you've got reliable communication back to shore, because if you go out there and start shipping water and you've got a dead engine and you want to start hollering mayday because life is at risk, that radio equipment is the only contact you've got with the rest of society. You're at the end of your rope, if you know what I mean. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
KC2WGB, let me let it drop. Well, you know, Dick, they go out that far, and they're on station overnight when you're fishing out there. These people, they're nuts. I tell you the truth, I don't know how they afford the fuel, because it costs like, I don't know, maybe $800 to go out and back just in fuel alone. So, you know, he's got the dollars and he's got the boat. So, yeah, I think two antennas will do fine. Okay, next question here is, gentleman has a radio intercom, and he wants to make a coupling network from the transmitter to the electrical wiring of the house. And he has a quick little diagram here of some coils and some 0.01 capacitors. And he wants to plug that into the AC wiring of the house so that he can have his receivers throughout plugged into the AC, because he can't transmit far enough and it's pretty noisy. What do you think the chances are of him being successful with that?
Pretty successful. Let me drop. There are a number of commercial circuits you can buy that do exactly that, John, where by remote control, you're turning on and off light, turning on and off a hot water heater, furnace, whatever, television set, lights out front. You can, by way of the wiring of the house, do a lot of intercommunication at HF and VHF frequencies, UHF frequencies. There are circuits that'll do that. If you couple into the 110-volt line by, let me pick a number, 100 picofarad capacitor, or maybe it's a 30 picofarad capacitor, because the 110-volt line has got 60 hertz, a very low frequency radio-wise, where the 100 picofarad capacitor would be almost an open circuit. I don't know the number. We can calculate it. Maybe it's going to be a 50,000-ohm capacitive reactance to the 60 hertz. But if that's part of a resonant network on your VHF transmitter, you can now transmit 90% of your RF energy through that 100 picofarad capacitor into the household wiring. And the household wiring is a very nice, what's called a carrier current radio system. Many a college has what's called a carrier current radio station. In other words, somewhere in the middle of the campus is a transmitter that pours AM broadcast, like 530 kilohertz, the bottom end of the AM broadcast band, pours it into the wiring of the college campus. And now each one of the dorms has a radio connected to that, or in some cases, not even connected. Let me drop. If your college campus is big enough, and if you set it up correctly, you can be radiating a lot of signals throughout all of the wiring that goes to all of the dorm rooms, and maybe even the classrooms, and then a person using an ordinary AM radio in his dorm room doesn't have to connect it to anything. He's now picking up the signal that's radiated by the wiring that's all around him. And so there are a number of colleges that do that. When I was at Pratt Institute, we were in the process of designing a carrier current radio station to do that. And as long as the strength of the signal that leaves the college campus, goes to the outside community, is below, I think the number was 15 microvolts per meter, as long as the signal strength outside of the campus falls below a certain number, no licensing is required. You're just doing AM broadcast transmitting on your own private piece of property, if you know what I mean. So to do that within a house, very easy to do. And now do you want to buy it or build it? That's a function of how much study you want to do and how much learning you want to do. But there are commercial circuits you can buy that do that. There are intercom systems that are already set up just that way, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn. I bet you've already done it.
Actually, I have, Dick, and just a couple of quick comments about it. That's an excellent system where you're going to operate on one side of a transformer. So in other words, as long as the transformer on your power main feed is on the, in other words, you're all on one side of it. In other words, you're on the distribution end. But I'm not sure I'd want it, that might not be a great idea for amateur radio. The reason I'm saying that is because I think the signal gets very attenuated by the time it hits your first major power transformer, and it may not radiate with any kind of a pattern that's useful unless you really increase the power. And if you probably start increasing the power to amateur radio levels, 100 watts or their equivalent of, you may start interfering with a lot of equipment, TVs, radios, other electronics that are plugged in the wall that may not be able to reject that all that well. I'm going to pass that back to you, Dick, for comment. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I'm in agreement with you, Glenn. With rare exception, I strongly recommend that we amateurs try very hard to couple none of our RF energy into the household's 110-volt wiring, 220-volt wiring. You don't want to do that. The original question is this guy is doing it as an in-house intercom. He's not doing it for ham radio reasons. So we amateurs should try very hard to radiate none of RF energy into the wiring, because what RF, what ham radio signals you put into the wiring are likely to give some kind of electromagnetic interference problems to other appliances in your house, as well as possibly the appliances of your neighbor. So don't do that. But on the so-called license-free frequencies for an in-house intercom, this is very doable, and I've seen commercial products that do that. Back to you, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the tech net.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I'm sure if he Googles that, he'll probably be able to get a lot of information and maybe get some ideas. But yeah, it's doable, and a lot of people are doing it. And you are right, there are quite a few intercom stations that you could buy commercially that will do it. But I guess he wants to build it himself. All right, let me drop. We got one more quick one. Okay, this gentleman has a question on a wire that he owns. He has a 500-foot reel of 600-ohm ladder line. And it's made by Bendix. And let's see, it says 10 to 50 kilohertz. I'm sorry, 10 to 50 megahertz on it. And it's three-conductor. It has, it's not delta form. They're in line. There's a center. And then 2 inches on either side of that, there's another conductor. They look like number 16 gauge. It's all olive drab, so I'm assuming it's military. It's three-conductor, and it has nice little spacers on it. Do you have any idea what that was used for? Have you ever seen it before? And it does say 600 ohms.
Yeah, there are formulas you can go to in the Radio Amateur's Handbook, also in reference data for radio engineers, which once you know the diameter of the wire and the spacing in inches, it'll tell you what is the impedance. My first question is the 600 ohms that it claims. Is that 600 ohms from center to one side, or is it 600 ohms between the two outer sides, and the center is just some kind of a grounding system? That's my first curiosity. I vaguely remember the formula is 376 times log of A over B, where A is the diameter of the wire and B is the spacing, both in inches or both in millimeters, if you like. Right? And the formula looks something like that. So there's a fairly simple formula that once you know the dimensions of the wire in diameter and spacing, it'll tell you impedance. So the possibility exists that 600 ohms between the two outer wires and 300 ohms between either outer wire and the center, in which case that would tell you immediately how they intended to use it. Let me drop. And the more I think about it, the more I'm beginning to realize that 2 inches of spacing is very small for usual open wire line. The 4 inches of spacing between the two outers, that's more likely the 600 ohms. So with that calculation, if you confirm that the 600 ohms is the two outer wires used with reference to each other, then you know that the RF energy was flowing down the two outer wires and the wire in the center, possibly with some kind of a grounding system. Now, there is the possibility of using it in a three-phase network. In other words, you're sending power down all three wires with 120 degrees of difference in the phase angle between the three wires. That would give you lower loss, by the way. If you used all three wires, you'd get a little bit lower loss than if you used just the two outers. The difference is going to be kind of small because open wire in general is very low loss at frequencies like that. Although 50 megahertz, very few people will use open wire line as high as 50 megs. Rarely do they go beyond 30 megs, 10 meters. Interesting material. And because he said that it was made by the Bendix company, it'd be nice to find a model number on somewhere in the Bendix catalog that describes what its intended use was. It's an unusual sounding material. I've never seen it. You've now seen a picture of it from this email you've gotten. And what do those spacers look like, John? Are they porcelain, plastic, or whatever? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. They're plastic. The spacers are plastic. Very interesting. I zoomed in on it to see if I could find out if the center conductor was a messenger for strength or something. But no, it's the same exact wire as the two outer ones. So you may be right. Maybe it was used for three-phase transmission of some sort. But no other information. And he has Googled it. There's no model number stamped on it or anything like that. And the label that was on the reel that he has, of course, is gone. So he has no idea. But he's got 500 feet of it. They're lovely.
In the case of three-phase open wire transmission line, 120 degrees phase difference, down the wire in view. And the three wires were aimed, were arranged in a triangular pattern, which is somewhat what they do, somewhat like what they do on some of the high